All right, we're glad to have everyone here this morning. And this is the morning that our gospel meeting is going to begin. So in a little while, Will Dilbeck will be preaching to us. He and Joni got in yesterday afternoon. And I think that everyone has seen them before and had opportunity to get to know them a little bit. But we have another week to do so this time. And so we're glad to have them with us. And very happy to see all of you here. Now, at the beginning of October, we're going to begin our new quarter. Now, I want to make some suggestions. Now, they're not going to be elaborate. In connection with the classes that are going to be taught, you have the one-year-olds, babies, basically. You're not going to be able to teach them the three-cycle approach, okay? So just don't worry about that. What you do is try to pick out several stories that you think you might be able to help them learn some words of by repetition. Whatever you do, I'll tell you right now, I'm not an expert on how to teach one-year-olds. Now, when I have one that sits on my lap so that I can just play with that one-year-old and try to do something, I might be able to do something there. So you just do whatever you can get by with in choosing certain select stories that you might want to try to emphasize to the children of that age. So my best wishes. But really, there is no way to incorporate them into a study such as this. Now, even the 2 and 3 year olds, you're not going to be able to do much more with them. So what I would suggest with the 2 and 3 year olds is you go through, see, that second cycle, except don't worry about breaking it up at this point. With the 2 and 3 year olds, remember that your events, see, focus on your events without breaking it up. So what would the events be? Well, creation, Adam and Eve in the garden, first sin, Cain and Abel. See, take those stories like that and choose a good number of those stories. And at this point, the thing to do is put them in sequence, but don't necessarily try to hook them all together, because you won't be able to tell enough of the stories to establish a connection between all of them. You're not going to be able to do that at this time. Okay? So choose a good number of those stories, but tell them in order. See, that's another thing. Tell them in order. Just because you don't tell them all doesn't mean they have to be told out of sequence. So when you choose the stories that you're going to use, put them in sequence, even if you don't establish a continuity of a constant narrative in there. Do you see what I mean? That you don't have to tell every little story all the way through to establish continuity. Well, with the 2 and 3 year olds, that's not going to work. So choose a goodly number of the stories and work with them. You'll be able to do a lot more with them than the one-year-olds. So that's what you do. Now, in the when you get to 4 and 5, they're still not verbal in the sense of being able to read. So what you can do there is to follow the same procedure, except there you can begin to use things like... There are different ways to go about it. One way is to get boxes that are labeled before the flood and use pictures. Use pictures. Use pictures a lot. Drawings and things like that a lot with them so that they can they can see, all right, here is the story of the creation. Here's the story of the flood. Here's the story of whatever. When you can use maps with them. When you use a map, you want to use a very simple map. You want to just draw your bold outline of your map and put on that map pretty well the only things you're going to be emphasizing. You know, don't fill the map up with everything. And just don't worry about it being anatomically correct. Just get it in the neighborhood so that you can make the point that you're wanting to make. And use pictures to illustrate the various stories so that they can look at that picture and know, oh, this is the story of the flood. And then gradually you can work with them and help them to learn a little bit about the order of these things and so on. So that's the thing you need to do there. So it won't be that much different from what you have done, except remember, we're teaching Bible, and you're telling the Bible stories. So whatever Bible story you're going to be coming to, don't write a commentary on it. Tell the story. And tell it just as interestingly as you can. And really make it come alive. And when we get up in grammar school, then the grammar school children will be able to do more with this. Now, we have a pretty wide span in our grammar school. And that means that whatever you do verbally for the older kids, you're going to have to remember that the younger kids in that class haven't yet learned reading as a skill of learning. Now, you have to think about this. You know, when children are starting to school in first grade, we sometimes think, they can now read. Well, they're still working on developing reading as a skill for the most part. So that means that during the time they're working to develop reading as a skill, that is not the time that you can have them use that reading as a means of learning. You see? Because they're still learning to read. So you're still going to have to emphasize a whole lot of picture things. So, provide some things like that for the younger ones in that class. Don't rely very heavily on the reading. Now, they will be able to handle, even the younger ones will be able to handle cards or things that are drawn on the board, just a word here, and they will, you know, you can work with them like that. The older ones, of course, will be able to learn and will be able to put this thing together, and you'll be able pretty well to take them through the first and the second cycles of this. I wouldn't try that third cycle, you know, where it is in Scripture. I wouldn't worry about that one at all. Now, when you get up into the high school, then yes, they can work on that some too. But in all of this, starting out here, I would work on the first two cycles. So does everybody see what I've said now? The youngest ones, the one-year-olds, if you're going to be teaching them, they're not going to be in this. You just do the best you can to pick out, select stories, emphasize those stories, repeat them a lot, things like that. With the 2 and 3-year-olds, more stories. A little bit more elaborate in the telling of it, but not a lot. And you tell them the stories. Tell them in sequence. However, you won't be able to tell them all the stories. For one thing, we're going to have 1/4. So you're going to be selective, okay? Select the high points. Select the high points and tell them things. Now, you can even draw that map that we have shown you. You know, I've come over here a lot of times and drawn that map of Palestine. And you can draw that and you could say, now that's Israel. That's where the people of God live. And after a while, I'll draw it up there and say, all right, this is what now? You know what land this is? Well, if they don't, I'll say, it's Israel. Well, after a while, then they'll be able to say, that's Israel. And then I'll say, well, you know what happened to this land? There was a time when kings ruled over all this land. And then there was a time, what would that be saying? It divided. So you can use simple things like that. And so the older the children are, the more detail you can go into on it. But you keep it simple, but do it interestingly as you can tell the story. And the thing is, you just pick any story. God came to Abraham one day, and God said, Abraham, I want you to take your son, Isaac, your only son, the son that you love so much. And I want you to take him to a land that I'm going to show you. And when you get there on a mountain that I'm going to show you, I want you to take him up and I want you to offer him to me as a sacrifice. And so you're going to burn him all up and you're going to make a sacrifice to me. Now, that was a very strange command for God to give. But Abraham didn't say, God, what are you doing? Why are you telling me that? If I kill my son, how are you going to bless me? He didn't say any of that. Instead, early the next morning, he got up And he took two servants with him, and he took Isaac with him, and they traveled for 3 days. And when they got to the place where God wanted them to go, then Abraham said to the servants, "Now you men stay here, and when we are finished, we will come back. When we have worship, we will come back." I say, that's what it is. That's what it is. Or the people on the walls of Jericho stood and they watched out there and they wondered what in the world these Israelites were doing, because all they were doing was marching round, and they did it today and then they went back. And then the next day here they are out there walking around again. Now what are they doing? And so they marched once a day for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, they started early and they marched round and round and round. Not just once, but they marched around 7 times. And when they had gone around that 7th time, they blew the trumpet of the Lord, and the walls of the city of Jericho fell flat. Okay, now, you see, that's what you do. That's what you do. All right, now, in order that all of us may be suitably impressed with each other's knowledge, I'd like us all to name the periods of Bible history. Okay, so I'll crank the car up. We'll get it going, okay? Before the flood, a lot of you did that very well. A lot of it depends on whether you have been here or not. That helps. A lot of it depends on whether you have been here Sunday morning and Wednesday night. That helps. If it doesn't, you don't know it. Remedy? Be here and learn it. You won't learn it otherwise. Now, where did we get to? Now, I know. Okay. Sometimes I talk about teachers that say, "Now, where did we get to?" Now, I'm wanting you to tell me, where did we get to? What have we been emphasizing in the details we've been looking at? All right, the divided kingdom. That was the last thing we looked at, and then we hurriedly went over the Judah alone, didn't we? What comes next? Okay, captivity. Now, in the captivity, remember that we don't have just a great deal specifically devoted to the captivity itself, except at the close of 2 Kings and at the close of 2 Chronicles, you have some of the information there. So remember that I told you that with regard to Judah alone and captivity, we've got an overlap. Do you remember my telling you that? That because before Jerusalem actually falls, there have been those already taken into captivity. Does everybody see that? So before the fall of Judah and Jerusalem, we've already got people taken captive. So the captivity begins, there's an overlap. So in the last chapter or two of 2 Kings and the last chapter or two of 2 Chronicles, we've got some of the captivity there. But the main thing that the main source of information that we really have about the captivity is the writing of particularly one of three prophets. Now there were three prophets that came along that were involved in the captivity, and the first one in point of time was Jeremiah. Jeremiah began his work in the time of Josiah, king of Judah, and he began his prophetic work there about 626 in the days of Josiah. And then the second one chronologically was Daniel. And then the third one chronologically was Ezekiel. So at one point, these three prophets were all contemporary. But Ezekiel came along later. Now Daniel was taken captive around 605. Ezekiel was taken captive around 597. And from the book of Daniel, Daniel would have begun his work, his life there in captivity, and the story of his life there, and so on, would have begun just virtually after he was taken. So almost from that point, Daniel begins his work. And then Ezekiel is taken captive in 597, and then it's about 593 or 2 that he begins his work of prophesying. So at one point, all three of these are prophesying together. They overlap, because Jeremiah prophesies until after the fall of Jerusalem, which was in 586. Now, if Ezekiel began his prophetic work in 593, do you see that therefore there were several years after Ezekiel started that Jeremiah was still prophesying also? So, okay. Now, Daniel is the one that you will actually have more stories to draw from, because you'll have the story of Daniel refusing to eat the king's dainties. See, here he is, pretty well a teenager, and he's under the command of the chief of the eunuchs, and they bring him the same thing that all the other captives, these young men are young men in training. They are chosen for their intelligence and so on. And so they're being supplied their victuals, their rations from the king's table. And Daniel says, I can't do this. I can't do this. He purposed in his heart not to defile himself. Mama didn't say, Daniel, now you know you can't eat that stuff. Uncle so-and-so didn't say, Daniel, you know you can't eat that stuff. There was nobody there to tell him what to do but Daniel. Daniel made up his mind. And I want to tell all of you, one of the most powerful things in the world is a person who makes up his mind. Okay? A person who makes up his mind. And that's what Daniel did. So he went to the chief of the eunuchs and said, Would you object to letting us eat vegetables, himself and his three friends, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Will you allow us to eat just vegetables so that we won't be involved with eating this stuff that the king has sent? And he was sort of afraid, but Daniel said, try it for 7 days. And if in 7 days we're not doing well, then, well, we'll see. But Daniel had faith. He trusted. And so after 7 days, they were looking better than all the other guys. So from then on, the chief of the eunuchs just said, okay, that it'll be fine for you just to eat that then. And then the next thing that happened was Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And he called all of his wise men in to interpret the dream. And they said, okay, O king, tell us what the dream is. We'll be glad to tell you the interpretation of it. We'll make it up on the spot. Now, they didn't say that, but that's what they typically would do. But this time, Nebuchadnezzar said, no, the thing is gone from me. You're going to have to tell me what the dream was and what it means. Uh-oh, because now if they tell him what his dream was and they're just guessing at it, they have no clue. And he will immediately know that they're a bunch of charlatans making it up on the spot. And they say, well, O king, this is not fair. This is not fair. Why, no king has ever asked his servants to do a thing like this before. It's not fair. And so he said, "You're just stalling for time. You're trying to deceive me. That's what you're doing. I'm going to have every one of you killed." And he gave the order. They were all to be killed. And while the arrangements were being made, Daniel saw what was going on, and he requested an audience with the king. And at this point, "Hey, Daniel, do you know what the dream was?" "No, I don't know what it was." "You know what it means?" "Well, of course I don't know. I don't know what the dream was." "Well, how are you going to do it?" He was depending on the Lord. And sure enough, the night before, the Lord gave him the same dream so that he saw it. Not only did Daniel see the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had seen, but he also was given the interpretation of it. So when he went in before the king, he interpreted the dream. And do you remember the story of this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw with a head of gold, the chest and the shoulders of silver, the abdomen and the upper thighs of bronze or brass, and the legs of iron, and the feet of iron and clay mixed? And as Daniel interpreted the dream, he said that a stone was cut out of a mountain without hands. The stone came and smote this image in the feet, and the entire thing crumbled and fell. And then the wind came and just blew those pieces of metal away. And then the stone grew and grew and grew until it became larger than the mountain from which it was cut. And then he interpreted. He said, what that means is that in the days of the kings of this fourth empire, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, but it will break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms. And then we have the story of another dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. This one was of a great tree, and all the animals fed beneath the tree, and all the birds came and roosted in the tree. Do all of you remember hearing a story like that? Some of you remember, but I'm afraid not too many. So here is the deal. There was a command. There was a command, "Cut the tree down." And as Nebuchadnezzar watched this, he's wondering, what in the world is all this about? Well, when Daniel, you know, was on the spot. "Hey, Daniel, come in here and tell me about this dream." So Daniel comes in and he says, "Oh, no. Oh, king, this is terrible. This is terrible." And instead of Nebuchadnezzar saying, "You better be careful what you're interpreting here, man." No, Nebuchadnezzar said, no, don't be deterred. You go ahead and tell me. Tell me the news, even if it's bad." And he said, "Oh, king, this dream is to your enemies." You see, here you are. God has blessed you and given you this power so great in all the earth. But you've been puffed up. You've been arrogant. And you are thinking that it's by your own strength and power that you've done all this. Now therefore, see, you're the tree. And you rule over all these nations, the birds in the tree and the animals feeding under the tree. That's you as you're ruling the world and everything like that. And the command to cut it down, well, that means that if you don't repent, if you don't change your ways, you're going to be brought down and you're going to be driven away out in the field and you're going to live as an animal lives. Do you remember hearing about the king that lived like an animal and his hair grew all unkempt and his nails grew like claws and he ate grass like an ox? And so Nebuchadnezzar, "Oh, thank you, Daniel. Thank you for telling me about this." But then some time passed by and Nebuchadnezzar forgot. So he was out there looking around all over Babylon. "Wow, look at all this. Look at all this that I've done. Look at all this that I reign over from horizon to horizon and beyond." That was it. And here came the cry from heaven. "You're going to be driven away from men. You're going to be given the heart of a beast until seven times pass over you. Until you learn that the Most High rules in the affairs of men, that it's not you, Nebuchadnezzar, but it's God. And so that very hour, he was driven away, lost his mind, you might say, lived in the fields, and yet there had been a little iron fence built around that stump where the tree was cut down, meaning that it was preserved. It was preserved. So that the kingdom was preserved for Nebuchadnezzar during that time, until finally one day Nebuchadnezzar lifted his eyes up and he said, "Now I know that the Lord God rules in the affairs of men, and he raises up whom he will and he brings down whom he will." And so he was restored and continued to rule over his kingdom. And then there's the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. Now, how many of you have heard that story? Huh? Yeah, more have heard about the fiery furnace. Then there is the story about Belshazzar. Now, this is toward the end of the time of Daniel. Belshazzar. Now, his father was Nabonidus. Now, see, don't worry about that at this point. We're just riding through the countryside. But his father was Nabonidus, and Nabonidus was not present at the time. Belshazzar was there. And as a good king often did, he was having a real blowout of a party, with everybody there drinking and having the best time. And they even brought out the vessels of the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem to drink their wine out of. And so as they were carrying on their party in high style, suddenly there were the fingers of a man that appeared over by a candlestick. In other words, near the light. And he began to write on the board. And it wrote, "Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin." Now, you and I, as we see that, we'd say, "Well, I sure don't have a clue what that meant." Well, that's because we don't speak. Well, let me see there. Okay. That's because we don't speak the language. But they did. But here is first this word repeated, you see. And then this word. And then this word. So he said, "You have been weighed in the balance, and you have been found wanting. Therefore, your kingdom is going to be taken from you." So what happened was, see, at first they didn't know that. All they saw were these words that had been written there. And when Belshazzar saw that, the Bible says his knees smote one against the other. That's pretty scared. And suddenly the party was no fun anymore. And all the wise men, "Tell me what this means. Tell me what this means. We don't know what this means." Well, by this time, Daniel was a very old man, because 70 years had pretty well passed. So see, you add 70 to whatever he had been, 16, 18, 14, whatever. He'd be well into his 80s. So the queen mother said, "O king, there is a man who's been here clear back in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. And in him is the spirit of the gods. And he can tell you what it means." So they fetched the old man Daniel. And I love to picture the old man Daniel as he comes in. Here is a man who has lived his entire life surrounded by the most evil influences. And he's just as pure and holy as he was at the very beginning, which means you can do it. And I picture that old man coming into the midst of all this debauchery that was going on, and all of this wickedness and all of this worldliness, and he comes into the midst of it and he sees it all there. And Belshazzar says, Oh, Daniel, if you can tell me the meaning of these words, I will make you third ruler in the kingdom, and I will give you a chain of gold. Daniel says, keep your gifts. And then he interpreted the words, because they knew the words. They knew what they meant, but they didn't know what they meant. In other words, they knew the definition, but they didn't know the significance. Well, that very night, the army of Cyrus, which was outside the camp, outside the city, came into the city, and they took the city almost without bloodshed. And Belshazzar was slain. And then the last story is in Daniel 6, because that's Daniel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and now 6. This is one you probably haven't heard before, I'm pretty sure. It's called Daniel in the Lion's Den. So that's the story. Now, the last six chapters of Daniel are visions that he had. And some of those would do to tell. But these are the stories. And there are stories that you see in Jeremiah, where Jeremiah talks about the close of the captivity and things like he's put in a pit. Put in a pit and left there, and finally a servant named Ebed-Melech goes to the king Zedekiah and says, look, they've put Jeremiah in the cistern, in the pit, and he's going to die. And Zedekiah said, take 30 men and go get him. And so they took 30 men and they went and got Jeremiah, and they let clothes down that he put under his arms, because they had to tie rope around him, pull him up out of that. Now that's a pretty good story, isn't it? See, and you can look in Jeremiah, and there are good stories like that that can be told. Lots of good stories that can be told there. But remember that in this period of when you get to the captivity, you can't just stay there forever. We will spend a lot of time when we get there, you know, in our travel through the Bible. But in this quarter, we're not doing that. We're just giving you an introduction to help you see. That's the captivity. See, those are the stories in the captivity. Do you all see that? So in this period known as the captivity, these are the characteristic stories that you would see. All right, now who are the prophets? All right. Now, the thing is, in the Bible itself, the order of the books is Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, right? But the chronological order is Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel. So, that's pretty easy to remember. You can just reverse it and then forget which is which. But anyway, that's not any real big deal. But if you can, it's handy to remember, because that helps you with the chronology of the thing. So just remember that the way it's arranged in the order of the books is the opposite to the way it is chronologically. And in the New Testament, you know, you come to Romans, it's not the first book written. So that kind of thing is common throughout the Bible. So don't let that disturb you. So this is the captivity. And then what's the next period? Have you made up your mind about that? What is the next period? Yeah, return from captivity. Now, in thinking about the return from captivity, you've got a lot of information to sort out there. And if you will do it like I was telling you to do it in connection with the United Kingdom, Divided Kingdom, you know, how to sort out the books that are involved, and then the people that are involved, things like that. You can do that with this also. So, the captivity, the return from captivity. The first return, just to designate them, the first return was in 536. The second return was in 458. And then the third return was 445. Now, this first return was led by a man named Zerubbabel. And as I've said, the only thing difficult about that is remembering how many B's there are. Zerubbabel. Now, children will love saying Zerubbabel. Can't you see that? Zerubbabel. I kind of like it myself. All right, the second return was led by Ezra. Now, we can all handle that, can't we? No B's in it. And then the third one was Nehemiah. Okay. How much of that did you not know? You got it now? 536. First return, Zerubbabel. Second return, 458, Ezra. Third return, 445, Nehemiah. Now, in connection with Zerubbabel, there was a high priest whose name was spelled sort of like Joshua. Jeshua, just a modification, a variation. Jeshua. Now, the other thing we have to do is find out where this is found. And it is found in Ezra, a book written by Ezra, 1 through 6. And then there are two prophets who also prophesy at this time, Haggai and Zechariah. All right, so what happens in this first return is that the people come back and they immediately get busy, lay the foundation. And then their neighbors come and say, hey, we're going to help you build the temple. They said, no, you're not. No, you're not. You have no part nor lot in this. Now, these were some of those pagan people that had been brought in by the Assyrians and swapped for the Israelites. And stuff like that. Now, F.F. Bruce, who is highly regarded as a Bible student, makes the comment that the Israelites, by being ugly, created a lot of trouble for themselves. They should have been more conciliatory. Well, it just depends on whether you believe what the Bible says about who these people were and that they were pagans and worshipped all kinds of gods along with the Lord. So are they going to have a part in building the temple? Not according to the leaders of the Lord's people. So I didn't think much of that. I don't blame them for not wanting them to help. They had no partner lot in this. They were pagan people that were living up there in the north. So I don't blame them a bit for saying that. But those people got real angry then and said, well, we'll show you. Well, the thing is, Cyrus, the king of Persia, was the one that told them to build the temple. So those enemies knew that they could not say, we're going to dash a letter off to Cyrus and we're going to tell him, hey, those people that you sent are down here building that temple. Well, because if they did that, what would Cyrus say? Well, that's what I told them to do. You better not interfere with them. So they didn't do that. They waited until Cyrus had died. And then they contacted. Now, during that time, they just did everything, and we don't have the details, but I suppose it was like interrupted shipment of supplies, just things like that. They just obstructed the effort, everything they could do, until Cyrus was dead, and then they wrote his son, Cambyses. But they didn't say, dear Cambyses, will you check and see if your father said that the Jews were to come down here and rebuild their temple? Oh, they said, Cambyses, we're awfully concerned about these Jews down here because they're rebuilding their city. And if they ever get that city rebuilt with the walls and everything, you won't even have a kingdom this side of the river. If you will check your records, you'll find out that Jerusalem has been a troublesome city and a powerful city. And there have been powerful kings that ruled in Jerusalem in the past. Well, of course, when he went looking for that, as they knew he would, because that's where they steered him, He found out, well, that's right. So he sent word down, official word, let that work stop immediately. I want that work stopped immediately. So the work was stopped. And the attitude of the Jews was, oh, well, huh, we can't do any more work on the temple, so we'll get busy on our farms and finishing our houses and a lot of the other jobs I've been wanting to get done around here. Now, I understand that exactly, because when I was a little boy and we started going to church, it wasn't near as much fun for me to go to church as it was to go to the river. And we had a 46 Mercury that if it's a heavy dew, it wouldn't crank. So I would always pray for rain, because if it rained, we wouldn't be able to go to church. See, it would rain and we'd say, oh, it's raining. Well, you know, that wasn't a very good attitude. As a little boy, I had to learn better. Well, here's the same situation. The Jews had now an excuse. They had an excuse. We don't have to go to church. I mean, we don't have to build the temple. We have an excuse. And they took full advantage of that excuse, and they went from 536 until 520 without hitting another lick at that work that the Lord had brought them back to do. Now, how does that size up, so far as you're concerned? How do you think the Lord liked that? That they went now, that would that be 16 years without hitting a lick, and that's what they had been brought back for. But instead of using the time for what they had been brought back for, they used it for their own purposes. And that's when the Lord raised up Haggai and Zechariah. And Haggai said to the people, now, have things turned out like, you know, he was talking to all these Israelites, have things turned out the way you expected them to turn out when you came back? No. You have something to eat, but not enough to be full, right? Yeah. And you have clothes to wear, but not enough to keep warm. Yeah. And it's like when you earn your money, you put it in a bag with holes in it. Anyone here identify with that? He said, do you not get it? Do you not understand? The Lord brought you back here for a purpose, and you haven't done that purpose. And therefore, the Lord has not blessed you in your return. But now if you will rise up and do what the Lord brought you back here to do and get that temple built to honor Him, He will open the windows of heaven and He will bless you. And so the people rose up, and Haggai and Zechariah both. One of the things they did was they said, look, see the foundation, because that's about all they've gotten done. And it wasn't near as big and grand as the one that Solomon had built. And they were saying, oh, that's just a pitiful foundation. And both of them said, don't despise the day of small beginnings. Because, now listen, brothers, sisters, I want to tell you something to get. Haggai and Zechariah were saying, listen, the Lord's purpose in bringing you back here goes far beyond that little square of a foundation out there. He's got plans far beyond that. Because Haggai and Zechariah were helping them to see that there were spiritual buildings that God had in mind that He was going to build. Can you all kind of look at that and see that here these people were standing there on the ground looking at this physical little square of the foundation, when spiritually they should have been looking beyond the days when the Lord was going to come, the Messiah was going to come, and He was going to establish His kingdom, and the Lord would have His kingdom here, you know, a spiritual kingdom. Wonderful, glorious things. And so the prophets tried to help them to see that. So the people got up and they went to work, and within about 4 years they had the temple done. So by 516, took them 20 years, because they didn't work, most of them. They got it done. So that was the first return. 536, led by Zerubbabel and the high priest Jeshua, Ezra 1 through 6, Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai and Zechariah are both important people And that's the scripture. Now, do you all see that? That we have here the time, we have here the personnel, Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Haggai, and Zechariah, and the passage, Ezra 1 through 6, and the books of Haggai and Zechariah. Okay, and so then we're going to Ezra, is just the rest of the book of Ezra, very simple. Ezra 7 through 10. And then can you guess with Nehemiah? Where he's found? Yeah, the book of Nehemiah. That's right. And then Malachi is the last of the Old Testament prophets. And so he prophesies toward the end of Nehemiah's time. So there you have the return. I'll say a little bit more about the return next Sunday. But we'll have next Sunday and then Wednesday night. And we'll be able to finish this by that time.